This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Night Moves, an Alex Delaware novel by Jonathan Kellerman. Read for you by John Rubinstein. Chapter 1. Nice house, if you put aside reality. Sunset Boulevard, Sunday at 10:30 p.m., was an easy ride. Cool April air sweetening the Seville's interior. To get here from my place in Beverly Glen, I'd driven through Bel Air and Brentwood, turned south a quarter mile into Pacific Palisades, continued through tree-lined stretches of architectural revivals, colonial, Spanish, Mediterranean, Greek, unidentifiable. Not a through street warnings at most corners, a planned community discouraging casual visitors. GPS-tutored turns led me to a street named Evada Lane, three blocks terminating at a cul-de-sac. Built in the 70s, tracked. The Palisades, but no Palisades in sight. This was flat land, geographically undistinguished, too far from the ocean for someone to smell the brine. In the Midwest, respectably middle-class real estate. In L.A., not a single structure worth less than $1 million. The house garnering all the attention sat at the tip of the dead end like a cherry on a sundae. One of the aspiring colonials, heralded by white columns, its brick facade strobed red and blue by LAPD cruisers. The same light show played upon a black Range Rover and a gray Lexus sedan in the driveway. All that wattage, courtesy of half a dozen cop cars, circled around a white crypt van waiting to transport. The crime lab van sat nearby, lights off, unoccupied. No sign of the coroner's investigators. Come and gone. Uniformed officers stood around, doing nothing. Radios barked police calls, dispatchers' voices impersonal as they chronicled the evening's malice and misfortune. Soft spring breeze. The yellow tape billowed. Just outside the tape, a mud-colored Impala, I knew to be Detective Moses Reed's current ride, sat next to a white Porsche 928 in which I'd been a passenger more than once. The off-duty drive shared by Lieutenant Milo Sturgis and his partner, a trauma surgeon named Richard Silverman. Reed had arrived just over 2 hours ago, taken one look, and called the boss. Milo, suffering through a charity dinner for Rick's employer, the Cedars Sinai ER, sped over from the Beverly Hilton and called me. "What's up?" I said. "Complicated. See for yourself. Please." He met me just outside the front door, wearing a hooded paper suit, booties, and gloves. "Yeah, I know. I look like a giant sperm. You don't have to abase yourself. Tech's nearly finished." He peeled off the suit, revealing a saggy black suit with lapels dating to the house's construction, a white shirt and a silver tie that had to be Rick's. Very GQ. "The almost tux?" he said. "Damn banquet. I had to take the pants out 3 inches. 4 would have been better. Enough of my problems. Let's go see a real one." The paper garb had led me to expect horror and chaos. Milo opened the door on surprising calm. A 2-story entry, floored in waxed walnut, was centered by a mahogany table hosting a vase of silk roses. A bronze chandelier cast reassuring light. To the left, blandly pleasant landscape paintings filled a white wall. To the right, a blue-carpeted staircase traced the ascent to a small landing. Milo continued straight ahead, toward another wall decorated by sconces and broken by an open doorway. A form moved into the gap. Mo Reed. Young, ruddy, still wearing his paper suit, but not the hood. Pink skin showed through his blonde buzz cut. The suit was tight in places, power lifter arms testing the tensile strength of wood pulp.
"LT, Doc."
Stepping aside. I followed Milo into a modestly proportioned, nicely set up living room that ended at a bank of French doors. Through the glass were glimpses of patio furniture, grass, trees. To the left, a dining room, and beyond that, another open doorway that led to a white kitchen. When people are murdered in their homes, it's almost always in the bedroom or the kitchen. Milo kept going, crossing the living room and hooking right toward a closed door. He knocked. A female voice said,
"Hold on. It's me again. Just a sec, Lieutenant."
The door opened on a paper-suited lab tech name-tagged I. Jonas. The mask was pulled down, revealing a young female face the color of hot chocolate. Tweezers in one hand, vial in the other, something black and wormy in the vial. She said,
"Just a few secs and I'll be gone, sir, but you can come in."
"Thanks," said Milo. "I want Dr. Delaware to take a look."
I. Jonas looked at me.
"Pathologist actually came to the scene?"
Milo said,
"Different ologist. Psych."
The tech gave me a longer once-over.
"Inez Jonas, doctor. I'd shake your hand, but obviously."
She shifted to the right, gave me a fuller view. The room was cozy and pine-paneled. What looked to be a library-den-office combo, with a book-filled Repro Victorian case and a matching desk. The desk's tooled leather top was bare but for a green-shaded lamp and a glass jar filled with hard candies wrapped in multicolored foil. To the left of the desk was an open area. A plaid sofa and ottoman faced a 60-inch TV. That left plenty of floor space for the man lying on hardwood between the couch and the screen. Positioned face up, if he'd had a face. The devastation visited on everything above his neck suggested a shotgun attack, and I asked if that was the case. Inez Jonas said,
"You bet, doctor. Tons of pellets in there."
She frowned as her eyes trailed to where the man's hands should have been. I'd already gotten there. Dual amputation at the wrists, clean and straight-edged. Stiffness in the limbs. I said, "Still in rigor." Milo nodded.
"CI says, depending on temperature, he was probably killed within 24 hours. Probably less. She's also sure the hands were cut off post-mortem, because there wasn't much bleeding at the stumps."
"Not much blood, period." Inez Jonas said,
"No kidding. I found a few little drops on the wood just under him. No spatter, either high or low velocity. Just a teeny bit of runoff from here."
Pointing to the neck, which canted to the right. A wispy streak the color of rosé wine trailed down gray flesh. She held the vial up to Milo.
"The other thing I found was this just before you came back. On the floor, under his butt."
He squinted.
"Plastic?"
"Yes, sir," said Jonas. "Maybe it's just random dirt that was already here and his pants picked it up. But I'm thinking it looks like it's from a garbage bag, and that could explain how they got him here, no? 'Cause he sure wasn't killed here, or cut up here."
Milo said,
"Done somewhere else, cleaned up meticulously, and bagged. Once he's here, bad guy does some fine-tuning and takes the bag. Yeah, I like it. Good thinking."
Jonas beamed.
"Psycho-crazy thinking, but logical if you're in that orbit."
Looking at the corpse had made my eyes and teeth hurt, so I shifted to a visual scan of the room. But for the corpse, as impeccable as the rest of the house. I looked down at the poor faceless soul again, trying to ignore the gore and concentrating on the mundane details that sometimes tell you plenty. Not tonight. Medium height, medium build. Age impossible to discern, but thinning sandy hair and a bald spot suggested middle age. So did the clothing.
a pale blue button-collar shirt, tan windbreaker, pleated blue jeans pretending to be slacks, white socks, white Nike walking shoes. The pockets of the jeans had been turned inside out. I said, "Was he left that way?" Jonas said, "No, doctor. CI went looking for the ID and turned them out. They were empty. Same for the jacket pockets." Milo said, "No face, no hands, no ID. Pretty obvious what the goal was. Now, the big question. How the hell did he end up here when the homeowners say they have no idea who he is?" I said, "Where are the owners?" "Nearby." He stared at the body, scowled, and played with an earlobe. His big, pale, acne-pitted face tightened as he brushed black hair off a lumpy forehead. A speck of some kind of foodstuff from the interrupted dinner sat just above his upper lip, left of center. Off-white, maybe rubber chicken. Or cheese. Another time I'd have pointed it out. Inez Jonas looked at me again. "It's a weird one, Lieutenant."
"Ergo a psychologist. Any first impression insights, Alex?"
I said, "Who are the owners?" My non-answer made Milo frown.
"A family, the Corvins. They left for a family dinner at 6:15, Sunday thing. They do it once, twice a month. Usually they stay local. This time they took a drive all the way to La Cienega, Lowry's, Restaurant Row. They get back just before 9. Everyone goes upstairs, except Dad, who comes in here to record a show on his big screen, and finds this. Moments later, Mom comes down to ask him what's taken so long, and screams, and that brings the kids down, and now it's a family affair."
Inez Jonas said, "Talk about a welcome home." I said, "How many kids and what age?" Milo said,
"Couple of teenagers, or the young one's a tweener. They did the smart thing and ran the hell out and knocked on the neighbor's door. He's the one who 911'd. If you've seen enough here, I'd like you to meet them."
I said, "Let's do it." Inez Jonas said, "Good luck, Lieutenant." Her expression said, "You're going to need it." Mo Reed was still posted in the doorway working his phone. "Anything, LT?"
"Nah, go home. Patrol can guard the scene."
"You sure? I've got time."
"Positive, Moses."
He told Reed about the scrap of plastic.
"Could mean something or nothing."
Reed said,
"Too bad those bags are pretty much generic."
"A bloody one isn't, Moses. On your way out, have a bunch of those uniforms do a 6-block search for the bag, for anything bloody. It's unlikely someone who took the time to cut off hands and take ID would be careless enough to toss evidence out in the open, but we can't assume."
"I'll canvass with them," said Reed. "Didn't notice any alleys or dumpsters on my way in, but there is that shopping area a few blocks west. Gotta be plenty of potential dump spots near there."
"Excellent idea."
Reed stripped off his paper suit. His on-call civilian threads were a gray Gold's Gym t-shirt and white sweatpants. Bouncing on his heels a couple of times, he jogged out of the house.
"Ah, youth," said Milo.
As we left the house, I said, "How many points of access?"
"If you don't count windows, the front door, a service door from a laundry room off the kitchen, and those French doors. Everything was locked when the Corvins got home, but the laundry door looks pretty dinky."
"Any security system?"
"An alarm. They're pretty sure they didn't set it."
"Casual approach to personal safety," I said.
"Nice neighborhood," he said. "People get lulled. The system came with a house. Sensors on the ground floor, but not the second. Like bad guys can't bring ladders. We looked for evidence of a ladder, any sort of disruption. Couldn't find any. And the second-story windows were all closed. I'm leaning toward the utility door as point of entry."
"Someone familiar with the place, knowing the lock was dinky?"
"That would explain it," he said. Yet another reason to play Meet the Family.
He scowled. I said, these people bother you.
So far, nothing says they're dirty, but something about them, Alex. I'll let you be the judge.
Chapter 2. That one, he said, pointing to the house right of the Corvins. Just south of the cul-de-sac's apex, an aspiring hacienda, fronted by a small, walled courtyard. A silver Ford Taurus was parked as far up the drive as possible, nosing a wrought-iron garden gate. The gate was padlocked, unlit, just black space between the curlicues. That made me detour to take a look at the Corvin's fence. White wood pickets, 3 feet high. I said, no lock. Symbolic. Milo went over to inspect, came back shaking his head.
Just reach over and unhook the latch. Can't remember ever being around here for anything nasty, so I guess I can't blame him.
We entered the courtyard, paved with river rock. Charming. But up close, the economy that had been taken with the house's construction was obvious. Flaking sprayed stucco finish, cheap metal-framed windows, a molded door of some wood-like material trying to pass as carved. The uniform standing sentry opened the door for Milo and studied me. She'd have to remain curious. As I had with the death house, I followed my friend inside. This entry was floored with Mexican pavers cracked and chipped at the grout seams. 2 steps dipped to a living room furnished with off-white seating and mismatched end tables. A wreath of dry flowers was the only thing on the wall. Sliding glass patio doors were ebony rectangles. A large, florid man with gray hair slicked and combed straight back filled an armchair that faced the front door. Mid-50s, navy polo shirt, khakis, brown deck shoes. The sofa perpendicular to his chair contained a thin, strawberry-blonde woman of the same vintage, pretty, freckled, with down-slanted, pouchy eyes that looked accustomed to stress. Her clothes narrowed her further. Black cashmere crew neck and tailored slacks, black patent flats, black purse. A foot to her left, a boy around 13 or 14 hunched and picked a cuticle. Long-limbed and freckled with a rusty faux hawk. His out-for-the-evening duds were a blue-and-white perforated Dodgers shirt, white board shorts, high tops the color of canned green beans. Positioned at the farthest end of the sofa was an older girl, maybe a high school senior, maybe a college freshman. Soft and chubby, with a doughy face from which dark eyes popped like raisins in an unbaked muffin, she wore a curiously fusty floral blouse with puffed sleeves, skinny jeans, and hiking boots. Her hair was brown, shoulder length, lank. Pudgy hands resting in her lap twitched every few seconds. The big man bounded up, flashed a nanosecond grin, and said,
"Hey, Lieutenant,"
in a radio announcer voice.
"Anything yet on the situation? You'll be cleaning up soon and letting us back in, right?"
Milo and I kept approaching.
"Soon?" said the man. "We need to get back."
The woman frowned and said,
"Chat."
"What?"
The man turned to her, smile vanished.
"They don't mind questions. Right, Lieutenant? Informed citizens are an asset to law enforcement."
A glance at me.
"New guy beefing up the team? Great idea. More the merrier. Let's clear up this insanity ASAP."
He held out a hand.
"Chet Corvin."
"Alex Delaware."
"Great to meet you, Alex."
His grip was fierce as he pumped my arm. He said,
"Might as well do the intros for Detective Alex here, right, Lieutenant? I'm Chet Corvin, the guy who pays the mortgage next door. The vision in black is my bride, Felice. Next to her is Brett, our star first baseman.
Wink at the boy. No response. Chet Corvin glanced at the girl as if in afterthought.
At the Siberia edge of the couch is daughter Chelsea.
Felice Corvin shot her daughter a quick look. As Brett had done with her father, Chelsea ignored her. Both kids looked as if they were orbiting in a distant galaxy. Their father's failure to notice was stunning. A fifth person entered the room from the left, the dining room and kitchen area, if this layout matched the Corvin's house. Short, sparely built man in his late 40s, wearing rimless eyeglasses and weekend stubble. Bald, but for feathers of brown at the sides of a narrow face. Dressed for stay-at-home comfort in a white T-shirt, cargo shorts, rubber beach thongs.
"Paul Wayland," he said wearily.
Milo said,
"Thanks for doing this, sir."
"Of course."
Wayland sat in a corner chair. Milo turned to Chet Corvin.
"I wish I could give you better news, but I'm afraid your house is going to remain a crime scene for at least one more day, possibly longer."
"Longer? Why?"
"We need to be thorough, sir."
"Huh," said Corvin. "Can't see why it needs to... Fine, you've got your job, but afterward you will do a thorough cleanup."
Milo said,
"There are private companies specializing in..."
Corvin's hands slapped his hips. He canted forward.
"You don't handle that?"
"We don't, sir, but I can give you some referrals, and funds can be obtained through victim assistance. So can compensation for temporary housing. But I'm afraid the amount won't cover anything luxurious."
"Forget that. We're not public assistance people," said Chet Corvin. "We've got a place in Arrowhead, so save the money for people in Compton, wherever."
Milo motioned toward the recliner.
"You might want to sit, sir."
Corvin remained on his feet.
"I still don't see why. Let's keep our heads clear, Lieutenant. Something crazy happened that has nothing to do with the Corvin family."
Milo said,
"As I said, sir,
if you need to be thorough, why don't you accumulate sufficient personnel to do that in a timely manner?"
Felice Corvin stared straight ahead. Paul Wayland took out his phone and scrolled. The kids remained lost in space. Milo nodded at the recliner. Chet Corvin sat.
"Well, I suppose you know what you're doing."
Brett Corvin, still playing with his fingernails, said,
"It was like murder, Dad. They can't just mess around."
Chet stared at his son. His eyes hardened.
"Of course, slugger."
Felice Corvin said,
"We can't go to Arrowhead. They've got school."
To Milo,
"How much does this victim's group pay, Lieutenant?"
Milo said,
"I'm not sure, ma'am, but I'll see to it that you get the right contact information."
"Thank you very much."
Chet Corvin said,
"What? Some cheesy motel in a crap part of town? I think not. In terms of school, the kids can get their homework and take it with them."
Felice Corvin said,
"We'll discuss it."
Brett Corvin said,
"Arrowhead would be cool. We never go. I can do my homework there."
His mother said,
"Nice try."
Chet humped and cracked his knuckles. Through the exchange, no comment from Chelsea. The hands in her lap were twitching faster. Paul Wayland looked at her with what seemed to be pity, but neither parent paid her any mind. Chet Corvin said,
"Back to basics. Who's the poor devil in my den?"
"No idea, sir." "What kind of lunatic would do that to a house?"
To me.
"We come back home, great dinner, prime rib, I can still taste the pie. Everything looks normal. We might never have found it until tomorrow morning, but I left my reading glasses in the library and went down there and did find it."
To his wife.
"And then you come down and scream."
Felice Corvin said,
You were down there so long, I got concerned.
It wasn't exactly a dead mouse, said her husband. I needed time to take it in. Who wouldn't? Something like that right off our damn living room?
Dying room, said Chelsea Corvin. Everyone looked at the girl. She mumbled. Brett gave a knowing smirk. Weird sister behaving predictably. Chet and Felice shook their heads, unified in bafflement, their odd child. The girl bent over and began crying. Paul Wayland looked ill at ease, a host whose guests had overstayed their welcome. Felice Corvin went over to Chelsea and touched the girl's shoulder. Chelsea recoiled.
It'll be okay, honey.
Easy to say, hard to accomplish, said Chet Corvin, looking at his daughter and wife with curious detachment. But we'll get through this. The Corvins are made of tough stuff, right, gang?
Totally gross, said Brett Corvin, with little passion. He sniffled, gulped, smiling as he mocked his sister. His mother said,
Bretty?
The boy made a hacking motion.
I saw it. No hands. Blah! Messed up.
To Milo,
maybe they got thrown in the garbage.
Felice said,
Brett Corvin.
Chelsea whimpered. Brett said,
Cry, baby.
Son, said Chet, that really is a bit out of line.
The boy untied a sneaker, twirled a lace.
His face was like that stuff you ate last week, the Italian food. Tartar, blah.
Chelsea Corvin made a gagging noise, clamped a hand over her mouth, and tottered upright. Panicked black eyes settled on Paul Wayland.
Bathroom?
Her father said,
What?
Wayland stepped closer to her and pointed.
There's a bathroom right over there.
Right-hand door on the way to his den. Maybe there was a matching room in the Corvin house. I'd been looking at other things. The hand Chelsea used to cover her mouth was white and tight. She faltered, gagged again. Chet Corvin said,
Go! Same place as our powder. Go, go on! Don't mess up Paul and Donna's carpet!
The girl ran off, swung a door open, slammed it shut. Retching and vomiting followed immediately. A toilet flush. More gastric noise. Another flush. Brett Corvin said,
Gross! This is like a whole gross night!
Milo said,
Mr. and Mrs. Corvin, in terms of where you want to stay tonight?
Paul Wayland said,
If it helps, they can stay here.
Tentative offer, but far from a commitment.
My wife's visiting her mother. I've got 3 bedrooms. A couple have beds. For the other, I've got futons in the garage.
Felice Corvin said,
That's so incredibly kind of you, Paul, but we couldn't impose.
Chet Corvin said,
Big of you, neighbor. Deeply appreciated. But seeing as Arrowhead's off the table, I've got a better idea. My corporate card from the company will get us lodging in a decent hotel.
To Milo,
At least for the day it takes to get our homestead back.
We'll do our best, but no promises, sir.
You're making it sound as if you own the place.
With a crime scene, Mr. Corvin, we do become custodians.
Chet turned to Wayland.
Thanks, but no thanks, Paul. We'll take it from here.
Sure,
said Wayland, sounding relieved. Brett said,
A hotel! Cool! Let's do the one near Magic Mountain!
Felice said,
What are we going to do about clothes, toothpaste, pajamas, your snore guard, Chet?
Mention of the appliance tightened her husband's face.
There's such a thing as luggage, dearest. Lieutenant, I'm sure you can find a way to accompany us next door so we can take a few necessities without screwing up your procedures.
I'm afraid not, sir. We need to preserve the crime scene strictly. If you need to purchase anything, the victim's fund will also...
We're not victims!
To his wife.
Fine, we'll buy whatever we need, and I promise not to saw wood.
Yeah, right, said Brett, letting his mouth drop open and snuffling wetly. His mother took hold of his arm.
Stop it.
What? He said. The powder room door opened, and Chelsea staggered out, face damp, strands of hair plastered to her cheeks.
That do the trick for you? Said her father. We don't want an accident.
The girl hung her head. Silence from her mother. Chelsea sat back down, rotated her body away from everyone else. Chet Corvin said,
Can we at least take our cars? They've been gone over, so sure, Mr. Corvin.
Ooh, CSI, said Brett. Hey, Dad, are you like a serial killer?
Drawing a finger across his throat and bugging his eyes.
Son, you might want to cool it.
Why?
I appreciate the humor, champ, but...
It's gross,
said the boy, jutting his mandible.
You can't make it not gross.
Son.
Stop it, said Felice. Everyone, just stop it. Here we are gabbing as if nothing happened, and all we care about is toothpaste. This is a tragedy. That poor man.
To Milo.
I do hope you find out who he is, for his family's sake.
Paul Wayland nodded. Felice smiled at him. Chet Corvin watched the exchange.
Fine, we've got a consensus on sympathy, so may we go now?
Milo said,
We'd like to talk to each of you individually.
Really?
Said Chet.
Not for long, sir, just enough to get some basic statements.
How much is not for long, Lieutenant?
A few minutes each.
Well, said Chet, I don't mind, personally, not that I have anything to add, but the kids, they need to be accompanied by an adult, right?
I am not a pussy, said Brett.
Bretty,
said Felice. Out came the lower jaw.
What? I can do it by myself. I want to do it.
She looked at her husband. He shrugged. She said,
I suppose, if it's brief and you promise to be sensitive, Lieutenant.
Scout's honor, said Milo.
You were a scout? Said Chet.
I made Eagle, youngest ever in my troop, record number of badges. All right, go for it, kids. Strong stuff, the Corvins, all the way back to King Richard.
No one had asked Chelsea how she felt. Milo walked over to her.
Are you okay with talking to us alone?
His voice was soft, gentle. The girl looked up.
I don't need them, she said. I can even go first.
Chapter 3 Chelsea's offer was challenged by Brett, and bickering ensued, the boy mouthing off as he dared to use obscenities, his sister sneering silently. Felice Corvin said,
Obviously, they're in no state. I change my mind, Lieutenant.
Milo said,
Sure.
He assigned a female cop out front to wait with both kids and Felice as we talked to Chet. The venue was a few steps away, Paul Wayland's kitchen, a 90s concoction of generic white cabinets and black granite. The counters were cluttered with takeout pizza boxes, KFC buckets, empty soda cans. Chet Corvin said,
Batching it, Paul?
Wayland smiled weakly.
Gonna clean up before Donna gets back.
Donna get on your case, does she?
Wayland frowned, pointed to a round kitchen table set up with four chairs.
This work for you, Lieutenant?
Milo said,
Perfect. We really appreciate it.
No prob.
Wayland stifled a yawn.
Excuse me.
Anything else I can do? Something to drink?
Chet Corvin said,
You have McAllen 24?
Wayland smiled weakly.
Above my pay grade, Chet.
School board getting miserly?
Milo said,
No thanks, Mr. Wayland. Feel free to go anywhere in your house or outside.
Chet said,
He's a free agent and we're... What a system.
Wayland said, I'll go in my office and clear some paper.
Chet said, Donna...
Milo cut him off with a hand slash.
Thanks again, sir.
Chet Corbin said,
Lucky you, Paul. Your house isn't a crime scene.
Wayland left, lips pursed, exhaling. Milo took out his pad and pen. Chet arched an eyebrow.
You guys haven't advanced to a handheld?
Milo smiled.
Let's go over tonight, Mr. Corbin.
Nothing to go over. We were out of the house at 6:15, family dinner, like I told you.
You do that regularly.
You bet. Family that dines together...
Corbin searched for a punchline, failed, frowned.
We try for 2 Sundays a month. Sometimes we miss when I'm traveling, but we make the effort.
What business are you in?
Senior Vice President and Western Regional Supervisor at Connecticut Surety Auto Home and Transport.
Insurance.
Reinsurance. Not life, not medical, nothing iffy. I do casualty only, excluding homeowner auto. The big stuff. Shipping, rail transport, interstate trucking. I'm in charge of California, Oregon, and Washington. Alaska, when our Canadian rep can't make it. Crazy place, Alaska. Transport planes going down in blizzards.
Sounds like a lot of travel.
Chet sat back and crossed his legs, warming to the topic.
Yeah, I'm troubleshooting all over. A little less now. Some stuff can be done with FaceTiming.
Conspiratorial grin.
More time for golf. This year I worked my handicap 2 points lower. Still, yeah, I'm on the road plenty. In addition to direct business, there's ancillary business. Conventions, meetings at the home office in Hartford. I handle a huge catchment area. Trucks alone is 750,000 cumulative miles per year.
I said, lots of responsibilities.
You got that, Alan. Big shoulders.
Milo said, So, you went to family dinner tonight.
Like I told you the first time, usually we go somewhere close. The bride likes to eat light, you know, women. The kids go for pizza. Italian fits that bill because she can get a salad. Lots of Italian places close by. This time I said, time for a change. It was going to be meat, prime, no holds barred, the redder the better. I needed fuel, right? Had to be Lowry's, right? If the bride didn't like it, she could order a salad. In the end, she had the lobster tails, and everyone else did the meat thing, iron in the blood.
He chuckled.
Cholesterolorama.
Milo said, bit of a drive to La Cienega.
You bet, said Corbin. Sunday, no telling what you can run into. So we left early. Turned out we had smooth sailing until West Hollywood, then some sort of construction, blocked off lanes, but we made it right on the dot. My timing was perfect.
And you returned?
What I told you the first time,
said Corbin. Milo smiled.
Fine. What did I say? Around 9, right? Still saying that. Can't be more specific than that, because I didn't check. Why would I? ETD, I can tell you, because I established the timetable. So obviously I needed to check the old roller.
Flashing a steel Rolex, he extended his head forward. His neck was meaty, taurine.
That work for you, Lieutenant? Definite ETD, approximate ETA back to base? Not that I see why any of this is relevant.
Milo scrawled.
So you got home around 9 and went to your den?
Pure chance, said Corbin. The original plan was catch up on DVR TV. One thing the bride and I can agree on is Downton Abbey. I like the history, she's into the clothes and whatnot. We had 2 episodes taped.
You went to look for your reading glasses.
I didn't have them in the restaurant, but because I knew what I wanted beforehand, the menu was irrelevant. Except for paying the check. For that, I borrowed the bride's glasses.
He laughed.
Pink, girly glasses. Brett thought it was a crack-up. Thankfully, the place was dark.
So you went downstairs?
Went downstairs, saw it, and boom,
said Chet Corbin, punching a palm.
There was no smell, nothing to warn me. It was just there. I was a little thrown off. Who the hell wouldn't be? You're in your own house and you find that? I mean, it's insane. It's absolutely insane.
It. That. Not him. Depersonalizing the body for a reason? Or just Chet being Chet? Milo said,
You were there long enough for your wife to come down.
That, said Corvin, was my bad, Lieutenant. I should have kept her out, but to be honest, I was still a little thrown. So she saw and started screaming her head off, and that brought the kids down, and now they're seeing it. She pushes them away, runs toward the front door. I'm saying, Where are you going? And she doesn't answer. So I follow, and she looks around and heads here to Paul and Donna's. We ring the bell. He comes to the door. Felice is totally freaked. She's jabbering. I take charge and explain clearly I'm ready to call you guys. Then realize I hadn't taken my phone. So Paul calls you guys.
Shifting his weight.
And here we are, team.
Milo said,
Mr. Corvin, some of the questions we ask you may sound foolish, but we still need to go through them. Starting with, can you think of anyone who could be behind this?
Negative.
Is there someone who'd want to target your home specifically?
Same answer, said Corvin.
What kind of target would we be? Dumping a body? It's not like it directly hurt us.
Milo said,
It could be a psychological assault.
Yeah, well, this has nothing to do with us. We'll get past it and move on. None of that PTSD crap I'm always getting from Teamsters.
Okay. Any idea how whoever did it got in?
If I had to guess, Lieutenant, I'd say the utility door. Always remind the bride to lock. She gets careless. Same with the alarm. She's a smart gal, but absent-minded, like the professor she used to be.
Professor of what?
Elementary education. Before that, she was a teacher, then the vice principal. Now, she works for L.A. Unified, setting up curriculum. Important job, all kinds of responsibilities. You can see how she'd lose track.
Is she in the district's main office, downtown?
Nope. Satellite. The Valley. Van Nuys. Paul's at the downtown office. That's how he and Donna found out about the house. They rent, don't own. Felice told them.
What does Mr. Whalen do at the district?
Search me, said Corvin. They're not teachers, some sort of paper pushers. He and Donna both. A couple years ago, they met the bride at a symposium or something. She told them next door was coming vacant.
Who's the owner? I said.
No idea. It's been rented out since we moved in.
How long ago is that?
6 years.
Corvin touched his chest.
Bought mine when I transferred from the Bay Area. Had to downsize, property-wise, from this great place in Mill Valley. But lucky for us, the recession hit. We stole the place.
So, said Milo, your rear door could have been unlocked and the alarm off.
I'm sure the alarm was off or the company would have texted me. In terms of the door, I'm sure she left it open.
Wink and a smile.
Don't tell her I said that, or you'll be aiding and abetting husband abuse.
Milo smiled back, checked his notes.
Your wife told me she locked it.
Corvin shrugged.
You know how it is, guys. Choose your battles.
Milo flipped a page.
Any strange events recently, sir?
Like what?
Hang-up phone calls? Unusual vehicles parked on the street or driving around?
Nope.
Anyone who didn't look like they belonged?
Nothing, said Corvin. Absolutely nothing.
I said, have there been any neighborhood conflicts?
Like what?
Disputes over anything.
Nah, it's quiet here. Okay, here you go. I just thought of something.
He held up a finger.
There's an oddball. Neighbor on the other side of us. Not that I'm saying he did anything, but man, he's different.
Milo picked up his pen.
Who's that?
Corvin glanced to the side.
Maybe I shouldn't have said anything. I don't want it getting back to him.
It won't, sir, said Milo. We're going to be canvassing all your neighbors, so talking to anyone will be routine.
Yeah, but I need to... Like I said, he's weird.
You've had problems with him?
Not per se.
But...
Nothing, said Corbin. He's just weird, so keep me out of it.
Half smile. Scout's honor? Milo crossed his heart.
Fine. His name is Trevor Bitt, writes comic books or something. How's he strange? Lives by himself, keeps to himself. No visitors I've ever seen. He never comes out except to bring his cans to the curb or when he drives away in a noisy pickup, a Dodge. If you happen to be there and say hello, he makes like he doesn't hear.
I said, not a social guy.
In his own world, Alan, said Corvin. You'll meet him, you'll see. But we've never given him a reason to hassle us. One time we got his mail and I brought it over. He took it, even said thank you, but I could tell he didn't mean it. Next time, on Can Day, he ignored me. Weird.
Comic books, said Milo. Corvin said,
That's what they say. I read nonfiction.
Who says?
I don't know, I just heard it. Go Google him, maybe I heard wrong and he's the head of Finland or something.
How long has Mr. Bitt been living here?
You're interested in him? Listen, I didn't want to open some worm can.
You haven't, said Milo, but at this point we need to look into everything. How long's Mr. Bitt been your neighbor?
Corvin frowned. He moved in, I want to say, 2 years after we did. So 4 years, give or take. I brought him a bottle of wine. No answer at the door, so I left it on his doorstep. Next day it was gone, but not a single thank you. The second time we got his mail, the bride brought it over. I warned her he'd snub her. She's sensitive, bruises like a peach. I used to call her that. My Georgia peach. She spent some time in Atlanta as a kid. Father taught at Emory.
I said, did Bitt snub her?
She didn't say. It's not like he's a topic. That's all I can tell you about him.
Anyone else in the neighborhood we should be looking at, even if it seems unlikely?
Not a one, Al. This whole thing is unlikely, that it would happen to us.
Milo did the usual repetition of questions that often pulls up info. With Corvin, it didn't, and we walked him out of the kitchen. Brett was seated closer to his mother, fooling with his phone. Chelsea stood at the rear of the room, staring at black glass. Milo said,
I know it's late, so how about we talk to the kids now, Mrs. Corvin? Let's start with Chelsea.
Felice shook her head. You heard what I said before, Lieutenant. And actually, the kids and I have been discussing it, and they have absolutely nothing to offer. Sorry, but that's the way it is.
Milo said,
How old are you, Brett?
14.
Chelsea?
No reply.
Felice said, She's 17. They're both minors, so I'm taking responsibility here. They know nothing, and I don't want their ordeal to be exacerbated.
Milo said,
Fair enough, ma'am. But kids, if you do think of something, tell your parents.
Chelsea mumbled,
Bullshit.
Turning, she faced us, focused on her mother, glaring.
I can talk. I don't care what anyone says.
Chet Corvin said,
Watch your tone, young lady.
Bullshit!
Felice Corvin said,
Chelts. Bullshit! I can talk!
A lower lip tremor robbed the statement of potency.
Chelts, you said you had nothing to tell them.
But if I did, I could! But if I did, I could!
Said Brett in a baby voice. His sister wheeled on him.
Fuck off, you little ass wipe!
Brett bobbled his head and waved jazz hands. Chelsea spat on the floor.
Aunt Dick, I've seen it and you are.
Her turn to smirk. Brett turned crimson and began to rise. His mother restrained him with a hand on his arm. He squirmed, jabbed the air with a one-finger salute.
Midget balls, said Chelsea.
The boy struggled to peel Felice's hand off. She restrained him with both of hers.
Don't you dare, Brett Corvin.
Brett flopped back against the back of the sofa, growling. flashes of red and blue as he bared his teeth. Designer orthodontics. Chelsea said, "No go, gonad!" Chet Corvin, stunned, had done nothing during the exchange, eyes moving between his offspring. Felice pushed Brett back and wagged her finger at Chelsea. Shooting to her feet, she extruded words through clenched lips.
"Both of you shut up!"
Instant compliance.
"Barbarians!"
She turned to us, flashed a frosty smile.
"Obviously, I've proved my point. Here's what's going to happen. I'll talk to you now, and then we'll be finished."
To her husband.
"Watch them properly and find a decent hotel. Make sure it's got good Wi-Fi."
Facing us, her back to him. "Honey," he said, glancing at Chelsea, then Brett. The girl trembled. The boy seethed. Felice Corvin said,
"You handle them for a change."
Chapter 4. Felice Corvin walked ahead of us to the Whalens' kitchen. We sat, but she remained on her feet.
"I'm at a desk all day. My chiropractor tells me to get off my butt whenever I have a chance."
"What do you want to know?"
Milo said, "Let's go over tonight. Your husband said you left for dinner at 6:15.
"If he said it, it must be true."
We waited.
"Sorry," she said. "I'm on edge. For obvious reasons. Yes, that sounds right."
"You arrived at Lowry's at..."
"Whenever Chet says. I'm not a clock watcher."
"Out for a normal Sunday dinner."
"Normal. Interesting word."
She tossed her hair.
"Sorry again. Yes, it was just another meal. No special occasion. We try to go out with the two of them."
She laughed.
"Civilization and all that. Honestly, I'm appalled by what you just had to witness."
I said, "They're under a lot of stress."
"Of course they are, but I won't kid you, this goes way back. The two of them have never gotten along. Nothing in common, not that that explains it."
She shrugged.
"Brett's a great athlete. He handles school basically okay. Chelsea," she sighed, "she's 17, but still in 10th grade. There are motor issues, as well as cognitive and perceptual problems, so sports are out, and learning's a challenge. That makes her an obvious target, and Brett can be unkind. I don't know why I'm telling you this."
She threw up her hands.
"Probably just what you said. Stress."
Milo said,
"We appreciate your taking the time."
"Sure. Can we get on with it?"
"Of course, ma'am. So you had dinner and got back around 9. Take us through what happened then."
"We all went upstairs. Then Chet went downstairs for his glasses, and I heard this crazy noise. It took a second for me to realize he was screaming, like he was in pain. Last time I heard that was when he had prostatitis."
A fact Chet had chosen to omit, emphasizing his wife's emotionality.
"My first thought was, he's had a heart attack, what with his weight and all the garbage he puts in his system. So I ran down, saw him standing there staring at something. Then I saw what it was."
She shook her head.
"That poor, poor man. It's still sinking in. Our house? How insane is that?"
We gave her time. She filled it with nothing. Milo looked at me. I said, "After you saw..."
"Oh, God,"
she said, shutting her eyes, then opening them.
"I really don't want to think about it. Don't know if I'll ever get the image out of my head."
Her lids fluttered. Pretty hazel irises settled on me.
"How do you people do it, day after day?"
"Time tends to..."
"So they say. I hope it's true."
She tapped her forehead.
"Because right now, it's just sitting in here like a...
I don't even want to fall asleep tonight, afraid of what I'm going to dream.
She sat down, exhaled, pushed hair behind her left ear. Spotting a Kleenex box, she grabbed a tissue, wadded it, passed it from hand to hand.
Everything's jangling.
I said, it's a terrible thing to go through.
I think I'd like some water.
Milo found a glass, rinsed and filled.
Thank you.
Tentative sips, then a deep swallow. She blinked.
Sorry.
Nothing to be sorry for, I said. Can we go on?
Sure.
So you and Mr. Corvin were standing there?
Both of us freaking out. Chet's color looks nasty to me, purplish. He's got blood pressure issues. I'm thinking, oh, shit, there'll be two dead bodies. What the hell am I going to do?
She drank more water, dabbed sweat from the sides of her nose.
If both of us had the foresight to be quiet, but we didn't, and that brought the kids down, and once I saw them, I snapped into mommy mode, not wanting them to see it. But I wasn't fast enough. At that point, it became utter chaos. Brett's whooping and yelling how gross it is. Chelsea's just standing there. Meanwhile, Chet's his usual inert self, what you just saw, rooted in place. And I'm trying to push the kids out of the room, and now Brett's had an eyeful, and he's white as a ghost. They both are. Chelsea was stunned from the get-go. As you saw, Brett recovered. He's not one for lingering. Chelsea, on the other hand, this is the last thing she needs.
I said, we can give you referrals for therapy.
Could you? She said. That's kind, maybe at some point. But not now. Chelsea hates therapists. We tried a couple. They failed miserably. What can I say? I choose my battles.
Same thing her husband had said about debating her. A family that saw life as a war zone? I said, so you have no idea who the victim might be?
Of course not. Why would I?
We need to ask.
Proper procedure?
Said Felice Corvin.
I get it. I work for L.A. Unified. It's all about procedure. A lot of it downright stupid. No, I don't have a clue, nor can I tell you why they dumped him in our house.
She bit her lip.
What they did to his hands, was that to hide his fingerprints?
Could be.
I hope that's what it is, because if it's some crazy satanic thing, that would scare me completely to death.
I said, hiding evidence is the most likely reason.
But nothing's guaranteed.
Strange smile.
Given tonight, that's pretty obvious.
I looked at Milo, and he took over, covering the same ground he had with Chet. Hang-up calls, strange vehicles, anything out of the ordinary. Identical denials from Felice. The first sign of a chord between them. They'd never know. Milo closed his pad.
So it's pretty much a quiet neighborhood, Mrs. Corvin.
I'm not sure I'd call it a neighborhood. That would imply neighborliness.
Not a friendly place.
Not friendly or unfriendly, Lieutenant. Just a bunch of houses that abut each other. I grew up in Indiana and Georgia. We had block parties. No fences between the yards. Even later, up north. We used to live in Mill Valley before we came here. We knew the people around us, rode our horses together. We had equestrian zoning. It was lovely.
Not here, said Milo.
Hardly, said Felice Corvin. Here you rarely see people, period. Weekends are dead.
She colored around her freckles.
Sorry, that was... What I've heard is that a lot of the owners have second homes, and some are renters.
I said, like the Whalens. Felice Corvin squinted at me. I said, it came up in conversation with your husband. You're helping them find the place.
Did he call me a busybody, like when it happened?
He said you were helpful. Ever the therapist.
Well, said Felice Corvin,
I did tell them about the vacancy. I knew Donna because she's in accounting downtown, came to our office to deliver papers. We chatted. She told me she was looking for a place. Paul, I only met after they moved in. Nice people, but we don't see them much. They have no kids, do a lot of traveling.